Today, from the Wings Archive, the political, spiritual life of Marta Benavides.
Anybody in the community, if they have problems, they will come to her. And since I was the oldest, I was always caring with her, with the people that came for support.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Hi, this is Frida Worden, producer of Wings. For years, during the war in El Salvador, Wings received a newsletter from someone named Marta Benavides. We never knew who she was or even where she was. Her mailings had return addresses from churches in the U.S. Finally, in October 1996, Marta Benavides came to Texas to address the Foundation for a Compassionate Society's Forum on Feminism and Fundamentalism. I learned she is a Baptist minister, yet she was an aide to the martyred Catholic Archbishop of El Salvador, Oscar Romero. On the local cable TV program Women's News Hour, I got to ask her more questions.
What I'm dying to ask you about is who you are, how did you get that way, you know, and why do you stand for the things that you do, kind of like the adventure of your life?
It's really an adventure, and I have had a lot of fun. And there are times that it has been quite difficult, and I question, oh, why this, why the other? But in general, it has been a very, very meaningful way of living. I was born in El Salvador and raised in El Salvador. My mother is a mountain woman, and my father is a bureaucrat. Both of them taught me things which were very, very important in my life. My mother taught me a lot about nature, you know, to see nature with awe and to respect it and love it and care for nature, you know. And my father taught me a lot about geography, which is another way also about knowing about nature. But he was telling me about my country, and he would put the map. And when I was very young, he was telling me about little towns all over and telling me about the problems and about what they grow here and all kinds of things, history. And one thing that I learned also with my mother is natural medicine and medicinal plants and about how hard the people work in El Salvador. And, you know, my mother always was rebellious about things. People had to work too hard for what they had, and she never liked it. Mm-hmm. And I saw it too, and I said, I don't like it either. I want it different. You know, always respect the people who are poor. Mm-hmm. And then my mother said, they are not poor. It's just that people have made them poor. And so many times, you know, that overwhelms you. And so That was a great, great lesson. And she was the person that anybody in the community, if they had problems, they would come to her. And since I was the oldest, you know, I was always caring with her, with the people that came for support. And it didn't matter what kind of thing. It could be that somebody was trying to commit suicide, so they would go and look for my mother and, you know, can you do something about it? So I would go with my mother, you know, climb through the windows and all that to try to talk with the people.
Wow.
Or console the persons that were involved in the situation, things like that. So those things really affected me. And it gave me a lot of chance to see life.
And so you became a Baptist minister, right?
Yeah, but it wasn't a planned thing, you know. What happened is that my family is all Catholic, and, you know, Protestants proselytize in my country. And I, in a sense, fitted what people think is a good Protestant, you know, because, you know, the Protestant work ethic. I was a very good student, and so, you know, so they went after me and invited me to church, and my parents let me go. And when I became a Protestant, like about 8 or 9 years old.
Wow.
They respected. What happens is that the Protestant church, you know, they didn't respect that my parents were Catholic.
Oh.
Because there is no respect, you know, when you think that you must turn from here to this, it's because this is bad and this is good. So I think the message that Christ gave for me is very important. I could understand and agree with that, you know, but I couldn't understand how the church behaved. So I went to study theology. After I got my degree in biology, I went and studied theology because I was going to be a doctor. But then I decided to go and work in a hospital just to see how it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that that's a rat race there, that nobody really wants to take care of people, and it's about pushing a lot of things, you know, especially pills on people and bunches of them. And so when I was studying biology, I spent some vacations working at the hospital, and I found out that, you know, that's not what I wanted. I wanted to be about health and healing, which is wholeness. You know, health, healing, and wholeness are coming from the same roots, but curing is not. Curing is different. You know, it's not about wholeness. It's about dealing with this particular illness. But in the healing and in the wholeness, health is global. And so I realized, well, I didn't understand it as clearly as I understand it now, but I knew that I didn't want to be a doctor taking care of people that were not taught how to take care of themselves. And so you have to help them to put up with life, you know, mend them in a sense. Ah. So that's why I went to theology.
The spiritual side instead of just the physical side.
But mostly because I wanted to know how come the church, having all the resources it has, it doesn't work for healing and for wholeness, but a lot of time creates a lot of the illness, participates with that. For example, at home, the churches were very much involved in maintaining a system that has not been about affirmative of life, of people and planet. And so that's why I went. But once I got my training, I wasn't going to really go and work for the church. That wasn't my purpose, because I never went to school to get a degree so I can get a better paying job. I always went to school because I wanted to know. I wanted to become a person, a wholeness in that too, you know.
Did you have a hard time in theological seminary?
It was kind of difficult. You know, just to express these things, to say, I hear the message of Christ, but I don't hear the Christian church giving and practicing that message. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't even make it easy for anybody to do it. They say, you're a socialist, you're a communist. And they started to attack me. So it was mostly men. There were not too many women either.
I wondered about
but
that.
The women that were there, they wanted to do Christian education. And I didn't want to do Christian education. I wanted to develop the principles of how the church work. I wanted to work with missions because they were sending missionaries into our countries. So I did a lot of research and studied missiology, you know, mission ways. And but I became ordained because of Monsignor Romero.
Oh, you worked with the Archbishop in El Salvador.
Yeah.
But he's a Catholic. You became ordained as a Baptist? Or?
Because he asked me. And that was really good, you know, because...
He asked you to become ordained as a Baptist.
No, he said, basically, you know, like, we were good friends, and I was ready to go and do whatever we needed, because that was right before the war started. So I told him always, whatever I can do, I will. So just let me know. And he says, come. And, you know, we were sponsoring this ecumenical committee for humanitarian aid nationwide, because many people were being repressed and families were being destroyed and people were being disappeared. So we were going to do this kind of work. So he was starting that, and he wanted me to run it. And so this was not a paid job. It's just like, let's do this together, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, yeah, I'll do it. And he says, when? Whenever. Well, now, he said. Oh, okay. He said, so I stopped everything I was doing, and I went and did these things with him. But he said to me, he called me daughter. He said, hija, are you ordained? And I was so happy to say, no, I am not, you know, I'm not so happy. Like, nobody can really, you know, control this.
Yes.
And he says, you know, he made a play on words. To be ordained in Spanish, you have to say, it means order, ordenación. So he say, you must become in order. You must, you know, tú tienes que ordenarte.
Yes,
because out of order, porque desordenada no me sirves. You're no good to me. You're out of order. And I say, I look at him. I used to call him Monse. I say, Monse, you're kidding, right? You're kidding. He said, no. They will never ordain me, because I am not into making, you know, a power out of the church, but to get the church to work with us and exercising the power that we are. And he says, no. You must get ordained. And I was the first woman to become ordained, the first woman ordained in El Salvador. But, you know, after his death, I realized that, you know, what an important thing to do, to have a woman working in the same capabilities as ministers together, you know, ministering to the whole country, bringing churches together.
It made you his peer.
Exactly.
That you were ordained.
And also, it was a statement of what he thought of women ordination. It's really amazing, you know? And unity. Mm-hmm. He always talked of unity in his sermons, in his homilies. He always talked about unity, that people must get together, and together you can do these things that you need to. Together you must ask of your organizations to have a program that really is responsive to the needs of the people, not something that they are trying to tell you what to do. People who are in organizations have the duty to govern their organizations, like that, you know. But there was a time that I thought about it, and I thought, what a statement, you know. And I was very blessed, and to me, he's very alive, you know. He's very alive. I cannot talk about him dead, because on the other hand, I believe that nobody dies. You know, life is eternal. Well, sometimes in Christianity, they tell you that you must do this and that and that so that you can be saved, you know, and that's the end of life when you die. You are not incarnate anymore. You are not in this body. But it's a spirit that's living in this body. It's not this body who has a spirit. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's where we get all confused, when we think that we are bodies that have a soul or a spirit. But we are a spirit having an experience as incarnate beings.
Wow. So returning to the El Salvador issue, are there probably a lot of people who don't really know what happened in El Salvador, why there was a war? Could you just say briefly what the situation was and how the Archbishop Romero, what his position was with respect to that, so why he was killed?
Why he was assassinated. Well, you know, this is a story that is long and old. I mean, the story of my country is the story of everybody's country, in a sense. You know, all of Latin America, all of the Caribbean, all of Africa, all of Asia, and many of the countries in Europe even have that kind of story, not necessarily as country, but as nations, you know, where people are imposed on. You know, colonialism is a means of saying, you are a means by which we get what you are. You live for us. Women are colonized too. Mm-hmm. We live for the other. In the colonies, there is the center and there is the others that live in the periphery. And all this life is in favor of this one. All that you do, regardless, even the rich here, are upset, because they are rich because this one's allowed them to be rich, but they owe it to this, you know? And so this poet said that we have 14 provinces. You know, my country's small, so we call them departments. And then we have 14 volcanoes, which is true. The volcanoes are beautiful, they are majestic, and sometimes they erupt. And we had one that was active. And he said, and we have 14 families who are oligarchs. We have a little bit more than 14 families, but they accumulated everything by force. If somebody is really very, very, very rich, as people say, filthy rich, it's been because he has exploited one way or another. It has taken from where it belongs to others. So at home, they were filthy rich. They wouldn't even want to go to the cathedral. They have their own chapels. And the archbishop before Monsignor used to have to go to bless anything that they needed blessing, you know? And there are coffee plantations, or cotton plantations, and sugar plantations. Do you think that people can eat sugar and cotton and coffee and really be nourished and live a meaningful life? They can't. So there is all this resentment for 500 years, and every time there were all these people fighting.
The very land that could have been used to grow food was all being used to grow cash crops for export. And then they probably didn't pay the people enough to make up for that with imports either.
Exactly. Yes. Uh-huh. But my country, you know, those rich people didn't care, because they were also in cahoots with the military, who was created to support that. So all this is what creates the kind of situation that people just got very angry. The prices of everything goes high. And so anytime that they ask for higher salaries, they say, you're communist. If you form a co-op, you're communist. So, you know, the military increased. And as the military increased, the repression and the oppression got higher. And so the only thing that people could think about is, we're going to start doing kidnappings. But then instead of using the money, for example, to go and feed anybody, in a sense they said, if we feed these people with the money we have, that money is going to be off. But if we buy guns to fight with these ones, and so it created all those conditions, and that's how it is. The other thing is that then if people get together, and we can start dismantling that in another way also, but you've got to really work at love and forgiveness and understanding, learning to work together instead of, you know, for example, at home, there are not a lot of public telephones, but any public telephone there was, They had a sign. If you see anything that is suspicious, call this. So, for example, I get in an argument with you, and since we have all this fear and anger and resentment, you know, we don't distinguish. Uh-huh. The same anger that I have pent up in here, I get it against you, who are my coworker. Uh-huh. So then, you know, there were people that started to call that they saw something suspicious in there, and the military were just coming in.
People were being just slaughtered and left in ditches. I mean, this was the scandal of El Salvador that started to make people in the United States aware.
What we did is that, you see, the military were not able to exist without the U.S. involvement.
Yeah, and you can all hear the from their ideology that they had bought into this, you know, two worlds, communist and free.
See, it's very, very practical, you know, because then you get a lot of money to fight communism. And who's going to say how many bullets you really fired? How many grenades? They even were selling those weapons in the streets.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And that came out in the United States.
So they were also arming their own opposition, in a sense.
Yes, because, you know, the more they use and the more dangerous, the more they need it. But on the other hand, the opposition didn't have to be any longer going across borders to get it. They could buy it right there, cheaper than in the United States.
Wow. But, okay, well, you represented another method of approach, presumably.
Well, we were working in creating what we call dialogue for negotiated solutions.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to create the people with whom you can have dialogue. Mm-hmm. But the military were not willing. They didn't feel that they needed to talk, least to listen, least to negotiate. And the rich, forget it, you know? And they felt very powerful, and they had their own bodyguards and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people in the military were in the military, and the spare time they were also bodyguards. There was all this money related to military. But in spite of all, you know, the willingness, the needs of the people to live created a lot of conditions, and enough conditions that we could find ways of creating this dialogue. What happens is that, you know, like, suppose that you belong to an organization, like, say, to the teachers' union,
mm-hmm.
and somebody else, I belong, say, to the co-ops, and these other people belong to the church. So we would talk, you know, I would say, for example, or you might say, well, we better talk with the co-ops, they are going through the same mess.
Mm-hmm.
So you send a message, and then we agree that we are going to meet somewhere, and then you make a proposal to me. Look, I see that this is happening to you, and you even have numbers. And then you say, and this is happening to us in the teachers' union, and I see that to the students and to the university this is happening. What I think that we should do is that we should get all those people together, and then we make them a proposal. And we believe that we should make a big, wide, you know, rainbow process of all the living forces in the country to take a position and have a unity march against repression.
Wow.
But you cannot announce it and come to this meeting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All that has to be underground. So I agree with you, and I say, yeah, I agree with you. So we make a formal agreement of what we are going to do. So then we see all the other forces that we're going to go and talk. And so you start talking with some, and I start talking with some, and then we form commissions, and then, like, that's how it works. And at the end, you kind of develop a coordinating committee. That coordinating committee continues to work and then send information, and it goes like that. So, for example, these were my friends.
Mm-hmm.
They were having a meeting, and they came, and they captured them. And what they were accused of doing is that they were conspiring for dialogue and negotiation for peace.
Conspiring for dialogue and negotiation
Yeah,
for peace.
Because they say, what are you talking about? Because that's recognition that there is another force than the military force.
Uh-huh.
And they were saying, those people, they are just terrorists. And so if you're talking about dialogue and negotiation, it's because you believe you are giving them force. And those people, where their bodies appear, torture, and like that, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I belong to a process that was about 200, 300 people, you know. That was about 300 that I kind of related. And it's only about 12, 15 people that we're really leaving.
Out of all those 300, almost everybody else was killed.
Killed or disappeared or who knows. It was very difficult. But I try to be very careful. And I always choose life, you know. I say, I choose to live.
Mm.
I don't want to be a martyr. Every time, even when Monsignor died, I had a talk with Monsignor, you know, already dead Monsignor, out of this body, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I talked with him because I needed to take care of living people here on Earth. And I told him, I don't have time to be talking right now. You see all these refugees I have to work with. But I want to tell you one thing. I don't want to be like you. I don't want to be a martyr. I want to become, someday I want to be an old woman telling stories, not only about what happened and all the great things that we did together, but about what life can be and should be and we can make it be. And I just want to be able to make history, not to be in history, but to make history, you know, and for that I need to be alive here on earth. Uh-huh. And so, you know, I was very careful. You have to know how to move, but it didn't guarantee it either. So I was also ready to die. You know, when you embrace life like that, you can die, but you say, but I chose this, and it's okay with me, and I love my life.
Yes. Well, negotiations finally did come in El Salvador.
Yes, in 92, finally we signed the agreements for peace, and that is good. But, you know, people were saying after the agreements were signed, it was better when we had the war.
Oh.
For many reasons. One is that a lot of money was coming in to help. And that can get people very confused. In all sides, you know. A lot of the people that were sustaining the war, you know, including the military, they saw that the money wasn't going to be coming through. And the U.S. needed that war to stop there because NAFTA was coming. You couldn't have NAFTA and free trade if, you know, who's going to buy?
Yes.
You can have the commercial wars, which is a different
commercial stuff. Wars.
Yes. But you cannot have the commercial war if you're having conventional war. So, you know, even the U.S. finally came about. But the spirit's moving. I see that it's the spirit moving. I don't care what other people say, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the agreements were important because officially the shooting stopped. But the problem is that, you know, you had thousands of people that had been trained to kill. To be military,
yeah.
That had been their life. They didn't know any jobs. They had to figure out how to teach people to become civilized, civilian now, you know, civil. But they didn't have the time, so they didn't do it. So all these people had guns, grenades. So young men that were in the military, that were very young, had now gone back to their communities, but they go, you know, I am tough guy. And so they get drunk, and then somebody's having a party. So they want to go into the party. No, but you weren't invited, you know, but you cannot say that. But the people just didn't talk with them or, you're not talking with me. And they want to dance with that particular young woman, and the young woman didn't want, they throw a grenade in there. And then 17 people, you know.
So they learned nothing about problem solving, about social
interaction.
No,
especially in the military, you don't.
Yes.
Maybe in the FMLN some, because they were about dialogue and negotiation.
And it was also an army with both genders in.
Yeah. Well, after a while, the military in El Salvador started to include some women in some things too. But basically, the military were not teaching people how to talk, how to listen. Shoot first, because you don't know if that's the enemy. And it creates those conditions and those situations. So right now, there's still a lot of violence, very, very hard violence. It's terrible violence. And economically, the commercial wars and all that is happening with NAFTA. NAFTA is supposed to be just for three countries.
North American Free Trade Agreement.
Yes.
Right. But it's North America, which is Mexico, United States, and Canada.
And it's very important, you know, because all those other countries live in the periphery.
In Central America.
Yeah. And they need to be part of this process for money. For commerce, that's not necessarily for the quality of life of people and planet there. You know, they have to figure out how else to do. But in order to be in the globalized economy, you got to be part. So all those governments in Central America are fighting to get accepted. The only other country outside Central America that has been accepted already is Chile, into the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Well, that's very odd.
Well, but that's because Pinochet had been putting everything in order there so that it can qualify to produce at the levels that they want for export.
Mm-hmm.
You have big kiwi plantations in Chile, or peach, and pears, and apples, and grapes. That doesn't necessarily go and benefit the people there. But my country and Guatemala and all of them, they are trying to fit into this new economy. You see, in order for NAFTA to exist properly, you got to make a lot of profits. In order to make a lot of profits, you got to make all those countries produce and be part of that globalized system. So you have structural adjustment programs, you know? Structure is that is already within the system. Adjustment, cut. It's just like all the cuts that you have here. You have structural adjustment programs here,
yes,
except that they don't tell you.
Yes.
who imposes that in our countries is the International Monetary Fund, that is basically led by the industrialized nations. The industrialized nations is what we call developed nations, but that's not development. You see, when you have to suck the life of others to live, that is not development. And so, are there any other possibilities? Yes, you can create them. You can choose, for example, to start working in a way right there, forming community. You start resolving the problems that you have together. You start tapping on each other's resources. For example, people from the countryside going to visit the national university and talking with the people from the agriculture department and telling them, these are the problems that we are facing. Mm-hmm. Can you come and visit us so you can give us advice on what to do in terms of our crops, in terms of our conditions, in terms of whatever they are facing?
So trying to get the people in the university with their minds and their resources and their skills to cooperate on helping the people at the grassroots level.
Uh-huh. But instead mm-hmm. of them being there in the university and saying, oh, maybe we should go there and help those poor people because they are so poor and we feel sorry for them. It is the exercise of your power and going and knocking on the doors and saying, I have good news for you. You are a big resource and you can be very enabling to us. And then there is the House of Culture, there is the bookstore, there is the library. You go and influence all that. And then you start creating your own reality. It doesn't mean that you get off completely, but you start developing sustainability. You start learning all your medicinal plants again. You start learning how to keep healthy living, but you don't do it alone. You have to do it in community. And so this is governance. Mm-hmm. Governance is about governing ourselves. And from there emanates how to have a government. So we, if we practice governance, we will be able to tell the others what we want when they are in those positions to represent us and work for us. Those who are in government are supposed to be working for us. We elect them, or those jobs are in service to us. And you see, but you got to do it down here. And so we do conflict transformation.
Conflict transformation.
Yes. Anything that is supposed to be a problem is a conflict. So mm-hmm. we figure out together how to make it an opportunity for growth and transform it, because it has a solution. Either you let it be and then resolve itself and it takes you away with it, or you transform it and make it work for you. So those kinds of things I'm doing, which is sustainability. And only when we create community and we govern ourselves, we participate in governance, then we create the sustainable process. It's not sustainable development, because development, they are talking commerce and a lot of money.
Yeah.
They are saying, how can we make a lot of money still without running risk fiscally or destroying the planet? Okay. No, sustainability is that we are the sustenance from where the solutions come. Emotionally, spiritually, physically, everything. We are the ones. We are the answers. We are the key to quality of life. It means we are the ones that create the riches. We are the power. Mm-hmm. So we exercise power, you know, in a very loving way. So we learn to choose love. To have sustainable peace, which is durable peace, we work on sustainability, the practice of sustainability.
Marta Benavides talked to me, Frida Worden, on the Austin Community Television program Women's News Hour. The crew were Lisa Hayes, Suzette Cullen, and Gwen Williams. Audio was dubbed by Lisa Hayes at Water, Women's Access to Electronic Resources, and edited for Wings by Elaine Jacobs. You can email us, wings@wings.org. Wings receives staff support from the Foundation for a Compassionate Society. Our sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.